Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for spring semester 2026. Today, financial statements. This is as close as you'll get to accounting in this class, in this course. Well, there's a few other places, but this is about the core of it. And we'll do a look at the numbers, and then I'm going to do this first part of this with a company that I choose. And then from there, we'll on Thursday, you'll see the second half of this rather ambitious chapter. Just a quick look at the numbers, and then I'm going to tell you a little of the background story on what's going on in the global picture right now, so you can get a feel for just why this is going on. The first thing is that we have, if you look at the numbers on the other side, last night, you'll see that Japan, actually, we have the Nikkei was trying to struggle to get back to break even, as it you saw it doing yesterday, or as it was doing yesterday too. It's starting out down, and then it's crawling its way back up, trying to get back to up to positive territory. It made it just for a little while, very early in the morning, before dawn, our time. But then it slipped back again, and Japan was down. Now, Hang Seng was down too. It just dropped right on its opening, and then it kind of drifted back up a little bit, but that was down noticeably. The Hang Seng down almost a full percent is something to take a look at, and there are reasons why this is all going on. There's been a rather hard shakeup in the global markets overnight, and you probably didn't hear anything about it much, but it was quite, it's the beginning of something very big is going on. However, going over, once the sun had set in Asia, it was rising in Europe, and so Europe starts out down, and it just never recovered. In Paris Exchange, in Berlin, it's dropped on the opening, and then it just drifted downward. And the Euronext composite, it dropped on the early trading, and then it just drifted somewhat lower as the day went on. Oddly enough, the London seemed to have some kind of a resilience that is not in other markets. It dropped off like the other markets did, but then it crawled back up. It made a good run back up to level. But it still was down about a third of a percent. Now, some of these countries that I am talking about here are going to be long-term beneficiaries of some things that have happened in the last 24 to 48 hours. But for the time being, they are increasing the volatility of markets. They're increasing the risk of markets all over the world because what's coming next is uncertain. And when there's uncertainty, that tends to be a down pressure on securities, on stock prices. And as you can see over here, when we get to the United States, we look at the VIX, and you can see that the volatility, strangely enough, the volatility itself has been rather volatile. It was up, and then it leveled at a higher level of uncertainty. Then it dropped down, and then it went back up again. So you've got sort of a second derivative going on there. The volatility of the volatility is increasing. So all that taken as background, the Dow is down so far, and we're a little past midday. It's down already 3/4%, and the S&P 500 is down 2/3%, and the NASDAQ is down almost a full percent. This is all sort of shaking up the markets. A couple of things going on here. You see that down here in the commodities, oil is finding its way up again. That means that you'll see higher gas prices in a few days, maybe. but it's also because of the increasing tensions in the Middle East. We thought we were through the worst of the combat and bombings and all that. Well, here we are again in the middle of it, and now we've got a couple of very large tankers. There are different classes of tankers. There's these little ones, medium, and then these enormous oil tankers. And a couple of Saudi Arabias have been, just in the last, I think about the last 4 hours, have been attacked when they tried to go through the Strait of Hormuz. Excitement, higher expected prices of oil, of gasoline, because of the higher expected prices of oil that are coming down the pipeline. The thing that's strange to me is gold is still slipping, and that's, I'm not sure what that's all about, other than that there are some, here's one thing I said, okay, supply and demand, classic economics. There is, I keep hearing that there is all this gold being sold to raise hard cash. Who's selling it? Well, the Russians obviously wouldn't be selling gold, but there's some other thing that's selling gold. Supply on the open market increases, the price goes down. So there's this may be that there's someone's dumping gold to get hard currency or something like that. I don't know. But that, I mean, there's not much other reason why gold would be going down when everything is going to hell. Here's the other part. The 10-year bond, we are now getting, we're now up to 4.79%. So we're getting closer to an absolute bad place at 5% on the 10-year benchmark treasury. Interest rates are going up. That's going to slow down the economy, no question about it. The reality of it is, though, that if we're going to stop inflation, that's how you stop it. The Federal Reserve is going to drain liquidity out of the economy, because the only cause of inflation is too much money. There are all these people who say, well, inflation is caused by these, they've raised the minimum wage, or, you know, companies are jacking up their prices and that's inflationary. No, in true inflation, systemic in the entire economy, the only way that can happen is if there is more money being printed than the economy can absorb. And that's what, so in other words, in order to stop the inflation, you have to drain that liquidity out. Interest rates are the price of money. As the supply of money goes down, the price of money, interest rates go up. That's one of the two major factors that is going on right now. That is, there are two factions in Washington. There are the inflation hawks, drain the liquidity overhang, and that will eventually choke off the inflation. The other side is, are you out of your minds? You're going to put us into a recession, and then people are going to get pissed off, and they are not going to elect us in November. So you've got these two countervailing factions. The Fed is in charge of the money supply, so they are, they're the ones running it now. Now, there's another reason that interest rates are going up. Remember that a price and yield on a bond are inversely related, mathematically. If the price of bonds goes up, the yields go down. If the price of bonds goes down, the yields go up. Here is the background on that, and I'm bringing you into a global world, a global sense here. We, in the past couple of days, we put Canada on a list of undesirable company nations for allowed to invest here in the United States. In doing that, we froze $800 billion worth of Canadian investments here in the United States. We froze them. And these were investments by pension funds. The vast Canadian Teachers Pension Fund, its funds were frozen, the ones that were investing in United States securities, bonds, stocks, things like that. So Canada has retaliated. They are selling off all of the bonds that they have from the United States. Now, that's how we borrow money. We can't afford all that we spend in the government, so we have to borrow money. We do that by selling treasury debt, treasury bills, notes, and bonds. The rest of the world buys those. In other words, the rest of the world lends us money. The Chinese do, the Canadians do, the Arabs do it, the Japanese do it. They are the ones who lend us the money. They buy our bonds. Now, Canada, in retaliation, is selling all of these bonds that it bought to fund our deficits. As they sell those, they are dumping the supply of bonds in the open market is vastly increasing as they dump them onto the market to sell them. That makes a fire sale situation. The prices of our bonds are going down, and mathematically, that causes the yields on the bonds to go up. That's one of the factors that is driving this climbing yield on the 10-year treasury, and other ones too. Essentially, one of our vast lenders who bought these bonds to fund our federal budget deficits is now dumping them, just getting rid of them in retaliation for us freezing all of those funds that Canada had invested in the United States. So this is where finance connects with politics, connects with geopolitical maneuvering and all of that. We're shooting ourselves in the foot, and these high yields on these are just going to get higher and higher over the next couple of weeks to months, and that's going to choke off growth of the economy. Go. There are a couple of good places. One place, you always want to keep an eye on some of the financial places, like Seeking Alpha is a decent place to have get some information. Also, background, you can read some of the financial articles that you don't see in the United States, like at The Guardian. They are much more honest about what's going on than we see in ours. We tend to, in our news, we're not publishing lies, but we tend to avoid in American news the really complex stories. What I can do with you, you could never explain this in an article in your local newspaper, but so you have to go to places where they publish to a more intellectually advanced audience. And I'll talk more about that as time goes on over this course. But we do have a problem coming up. Now let's go down here and have a look at these sectors. Technology stocks were down yesterday, and they're down again today. They're taking a beating. There's a lot of red here. This is a bear day. There's no question that this is a bear day. But a bear day is not enough to explain, well, are all of them going down for all the very same reasons? Well, some of it is the same reasons. All of these sectors are going down because volatility, uncertainty is going up. So that's suppressing all of them. But some of them are going down for other reasons as well. The technology sector, it's overvalued by a terrible amount. And what we're seeing now is the beginning of the end of that giant overvaluation. It's not going to crash. There's no question. It's not going to crash. There are too many powerful brokerage houses and wealthy people who are never going to let it fall to intrinsic value. However, it's going to erode because essentially a lot of these artificial intelligence companies, their business model is, well, we're going to have all of these revenues coming in because we charge subscription fees. We give a little free layer to to the little people, but then we're charging these fees, like $20 a month up to $3,000 a month to businesses. And they're all going to pay this, and that's how we're going to make money off these insanely big investments that we're making, borrowing money like there's no tomorrow. The problem is twofold. One is that they're there's only so much, so many data centers, so many users of artificial intelligence out there. And we're also beginning to see that love of AI among companies kind of easing off a little bit. Some companies that thought they were going to be able to fire almost all of their employees, well, I'll be darned, they're beginning to hire them back because apparently AIs don't do as well with human-oriented interactions and stuff like that as they had hoped they would. If any of you have ever tried to go on a talk, call a place, and you got a chat bot, you'll know exactly what I mean. But there's another factor involved too. And it was really a punch in the face last week. A model, an AI model, just sort of came out of nowhere. And at first, we didn't know where it was coming from. It just showed up. And it was called Ox Alpha. Completely free, incredibly powerful. And who the hell did it? It can do anything Claude or ChatGPT could do, or Gemini Pro, or one of those models. And it's free. So in other words, all of these companies like OpenAI and XAI and Claude, they were counting on all this revenue because people are going to have to pay for this AI wonder. And here comes this free model. And several others are showing up completely free. Well, who in the hell is doing that? It took some forensic investigation, but there's a pretty good guess that it came out of one of the labs at a university in China, and they're just handing it out. Here you go. Whole world, this is free. Use it for whatever you want, and you don't even have to worry about, you know, blowing through your tokens, as we call them. It's free. And that is a massive, sudden challenge to the business model that is driving that was driving those technology stocks to those stratospheric heights. Suddenly, there's a competitor who's giving it away. And where is that revenue stream now going to come from? XAI, OpenAI, and Claude. You were planning to make money off everyone because they had to pay you. And suddenly these free models are coming out all over the place. And if you're enough of a geek like I am, I've got my own AI running on my own computer now. So I don't even need to go to those other ones to do the stuff. And more and more people are going to be able to make a local AI that does everything that they need it to do, including cheat on your homework in classes without ever going outside and paying a subscription fee. So there's where the problem is resting right now. Yeah.
From your experience, would you say that it's a kind of like an economic warfare with everything locally going on?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's delicious. It's war on the trade front. It's war on the AI front. It's war on the space weaponization front. It's war everywhere, and war is always profitable if you know how to play it. Anyway, I won't fatigue you with that, but I want to give you an idea of the world you're stepping into. It is quite a thing right now. It's one of the most exciting times in history. And one of the great things about it is there is not as much bloodshed as there has been in previous revolutions, at least not yet. Now, let me take you on here. I'm going to show you something here. I'm going to put up a company, and we're going to use that for the platform for talking about financial statements. And on Thursday, I'll bring up serious financial statements. Today, I'll just pull up some, you know, kind of half-baked ones from Yahoo for a company. And here's the thing. When I pull up financial statements, you're going to see pretty quickly the difference between finance and accounting. Because the first thing I don't do, you will notice, is I'm not going to grab an Excel sheet. I'm not going to grab a calculator. I'm going to recon the numbers. I'm going to look at them and ask myself questions on a human common sense level. What are these numbers telling me? before I even do a calculations, and we'll do some calculations, there's no question about that, and I'll write some on the board today, a few little quick dirty calculations, but before anything else, we want to know what our sense is of what we're seeing. I will use for this example, now as a caution here, financial statements vary in a lot of ways, obviously, from one company to another. But some financial statements are, they are so weird these days. For example, high technology companies. I wouldn't even try to show those in a class at this level or even a couple of levels above this one because the entries, they're just not normal traditional entries. Things like your inventory and stuff like that, they don't make sense. They don't fit our typical accounting models, how they report. You want to look for companies that are more of the traditional types of companies. You know, companies like Coca-Cola, companies like Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, Colgate-Palmolive, companies like that, that have more or less normal financial statements. Now, the one that I'll look at today, and again, I'm going to look at some sloppy financial statements instead of ones from a reputable site, and I'll do the ones from a reputable site on Thursday. And when I'm finished, I will also upload the financial statements to class spreadsheets so that you can go in and look at them for yourself as well. So you don't need to write down a whole lot right now. But to get the ball rolling, I'm going to do Home Depot, HD. And I'll go over and grab some financial statements. A caution to you, though. Even in the realm of normal companies with normal-looking financial statements, there are some traps and some pitfalls that you might fall into. A generation ago, every financial statement would have all of the same lines, one after the other after the other. You know, your revenues, your cost of goods sold, your gross margin, your sales and general and administrative expenses. They would all do that they were all the same. These days, a couple of things have changed. One is the same entry that could mean the same thing. Two companies could call it two very different things. And you have to stop and say, okay, is this what I think it is? Because it doesn't have the same name as I learned in my accounting class. Okay, that's the first thing. And then there's another thing. There are lines missing from some financial statements. And you're just left, what happened here? Why isn't this here? One is gross margin. Gross margin is nothing but revenue minus cost of goods sold. Gross margin, or gross profit, you could call it, or gross income is gross profit or gross income. I didn't mean gross margin. But some companies don't report it. They just go from cost of goods sold, and they just keep plowing down through the expenses without that stopping point at gross income. That's one thing. So if we see a company that doesn't have it, we have to insert a line to put it in there. Another thing that I was caught off guard, I pulled up Target's financial statements and I went to the balance sheet and there were no accounts receivable. They weren't there. And I thought, this has got to be a mistake. And I looked at previous years, there were no accounts receivable. Now, Target's a company that has accounts receivable. There's a Target credit card. They harass you to get it every time you try to check out there, for heaven's sakes. Don't tell me you don't have accounts receivable. But it's not being reported. I actually had to dig down into the 10K, the annual report of the company to the SEC. And it turns out that Target is one of these companies that is now has its accounts receivable in a completely separate entity. It's sort of like a captive, we might call it. So they don't report accounts receivable because that's technically another company that has its receivables. But they really are Target's receivables, but it doesn't have them on the balance sheet. Essentially, it's hiding accounts receivable from us. So you got to watch it a little bit with these when you're looking at them for things like that. But without further ado, let me grab the, bear with me, Home Depot financials here. And this is in Yahoo for Home Depot. Okay. I'm looking at the income statement first. Now, these are, I'm comfortable with the newest on the left and the oldest on the right, but these are the opposite. Oldest is on the left, newest is on the right. And we'll ignore this column at the end, TTM, and we'll just look at the actual full fiscal year reports. There are four columns of those. And before I go any further, like I said, we're going to recon before we go in there and get shot up trying to do math and all that. If you look at those, start at the top, revenues. Looking from the left to the right, from 2023 fiscal to 2026 fiscal, what is it that you see? What do you see in those revenues? They're big numbers, obviously. But I see 157.48, 152.67, 159.51, $164.08 billion. It's fluctuating, but it's also rising. I see that those numbers are walking upward. See, that's a sign, that's actually a good sign. Its revenues are growing. It doesn't look like they're spectacular, but at least it's growing. So right off the bat, I've got one positive marker. This company is actually growing its revenues, which is a very good thing. That's nice to know. I look one line down at what they pay for those goods that they sold, that stuff that they sold. And I see that it is also, well, it dipped there, but then it popped back up, went up again. It's rising too. So revenues over those 4 years went up by what? About $6 billion. Is that right? Three and four. That's about maybe $7 billion. And cost of goods sold went up by about $5 billion. Okay. So we have clearly that the cost of goods sold is rising in line with the revenues. In other words, you don't see cost of goods sold running up faster than revenues. That's what it looks like visually to an analyst. The first time you look at this, you say, okay, revenues are rising, cost of goods are not out of control, they're rising at a commensurate rate. So we've got something good going on here. So there's your gross profit. Over the period of the 4 years, it has risen at least somewhat. It's risen by $2 billion. Well, that's a little bit concerning to me because their revenues, their gross profit went up $2 billion, but their revenues went up by $7 billion. So that's a little concern right there that the gross profit, in other words, how much of every dollar survived buying the goods to sell. Well, it didn't go up as fast. So that's a little bit of a concern to us right there. Now, the operating expenses, OPEX, there's one where they're consolidating a lot of operating expenses, selling general and administrative expenses and some other things. And one thing I do notice is that they're not listing depreciation expense in there. Some companies actually show you that they're subtracting out depreciation expense. This company isn't mentioning whether it does or not. Those financials aren't telling me that. That's a little concern, but one way or the other, we go down to operating income, and there's where we begin to see a problem. Do you see it? Look at the operating income. In other words, after you've paid your suppliers for the goods that you sold, and after you've paid your workers, you've paid your light bills and all of that kind of stuff, they actually lost ground. They slid by a rather noticeable $3.5-4 billion. Their operating income has lost ground. So there's a problem right there. So next we are going to look at and they don't list their interest expense, so it's hard to tell what they paid in interest. But their pre-tax, as you can see, right before they pay their taxes, they have lost ground, and it's noticeable, the ground they've lost. And we put in this, throw in the taxes they've got, they've haven't put paid as much in taxes, partly because of all the tax loopholes and all that that are available. So we look at the net income. There we go. They have lost, they have on from $17 billion, they have dropped over 4 years by about $3 billion. That is noticeable. The company has lost strength. It's still profitable. Obviously, you can see net income is positive. Profit is positive. But it is losing ground. The question would be, why? And then we begin to think about, and to a certain extent, you have to be sort of a knowledgeable about an industry. Home Depot is in the industry of goods and services for construction companies that build houses and people improving their houses and all that kind of stuff, and rental properties, all that kind of stuff. The business that they're in has a couple of 800-pound gorillas in it they compete against. One of those is Lowe's, and there is also on a somewhat lesser scale, Menards. And they also have regional competitors, too, that provide those kinds of lumber and carpeting and plumbing stuff. So they do have, they're in an industry where there are large and small competitors nipping at their heels all the time. Okay, that's fine. However, we still see that they lost money. They're losing a competitive edge that they had at one time, and it's slipping away from them. Again, they're still profitable, yay for them, but they're not as profitable as they were even 4 years ago. So that's a concern right there to an analyst. Now, go down here. There are two earnings per share. Now, earnings per share, you take the profit divided by the number of shares outstanding. So in other words, that's how much profit each share of stock owns as the residual. They paid all their bills in a timely manner. That was operating expenses and interest expense. And they're all done with that. How much is left for the shareholders per share? And there are two of those. There's the basic EPS, and then there's a diluted EPS. Now, the EPS, you just take the earnings, the profit divided by the number of shares outstanding. The diluted is what happens if shares that are pledged but aren't out there, already out there, are included in. That would be shares that would be from like options, stock options, and committed to as partial compensation, those kinds of shares that aren't actually counted as outstanding. But sometime in the future, they will pop up out of nowhere. And so in a case like this, that's a very small number of shares. As you can see, the total shares that could be outstanding is always going to be larger than the number of shares that are actually outstanding. In this case, obviously, that's not very many shares that are added when you divide by the total possible shares outstanding. It's a very small difference there. Per share. But in some cases, it's actually a noticeable difference when you have these companies that give away a lot of shares to their executives and say, oh, these, you can collect these in 5 years or something like that. But in the case of Home Depot, it's a very modest number. Okay. Now, oh, here's your income expense. That's usually interest expense. You notice something here? This is how much they're paying in interest every year for the money that they've borrowed. You see how that number is going up? They're borrowing more money, so they're paying more interest every year. They are what we call leveraging. They're using more debt every year to finance their operations and their capital expenditures. Build a new store, Home Depot store in some city? Well, there looks like they're borrowing a lot of the money to do that. So we see some troubling signs here. A company that is becoming less profitable, and it is borrowing more money to finance its capital structure, its capital improvements and new buildings. Now, here's one down here that I want to bring up. EBIT is another name for operating income, earnings before interest and taxes. You'll see some companies up here. See this right up here. Let me get it up here. Operating income. See that right there? Op Inc. That's the same as EBIT, more or less. They're just different ways of saying the same thing. Now, EBITDA is earnings before interest and taxes and depreciation and amortization. In other words, EBITDA is EBIT and adding back in depreciation and amortization. It's gotten popular in recent years because depreciation expense doesn't really exist. Even though we subtract it in the operating expenses, there is no such thing as depreciation expense. You will never write a check to depreciation. You never will. And it's one of the ways that the accounting statements sort of mislead us. And we don't want to. Here's the thing. I'll give you a good example. In my own company, years back, I bought a $4,500 lens. Very expensive. Okay, $4,500 came out of my pocket. The problem is that I'm not allowed to say that on the income statement. I'm not allowed to subtract $4,500. I am required to capitalize it and then depreciate a little of that $4,500 every year. I'm not being honest in the financial statement about what happened. I blew out $4,500, but on my income statement for the next 5 years, I had to subtract only part of that. If it were straight line over 5 years, that would have been about $900 a year. So the depreciation and expense doesn't even capture reality of cash flow. And so this EBITDA has sort of corrected part of that by saying there was no depreciation expense. We didn't write a check to anyone called depreciation. So why did we take it away? Here it is, here is the operating income, but with that depreciation expense not taken out of it. So that, again, this has gotten pretty popular in the last, I hear more often when I'm talking with executives and finance people, they'll say, well, EBITDA, that's the way they pronounce it. They say EBITDA was. They don't even say Op Inc., operating income. They just say EBITDA. EBITDA or EBITDA or whatever. So that's just a little bit of a look. And again, it doesn't serve your purposes as well if I just, all right, let's look at these income statements and let's calculate this and see this is this minus this and all that. I can do that. Excel can do it a lot faster than I can and probably get the answers more often right than I do. But it's better to just look at them for a while on their own without getting too fancy. Now, let me take you over here to the balance sheet for a while. And again, we're going to just prowl around a little bit, and I'll write a couple of things on the board here. The first thing is that assets, we break those down into current, and then long-term. We do the same thing with liabilities, current liabilities and long-term liabilities. Current has to do with a term called liquidity. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Now, if I repeat a definition that many times, you will have it on an exam or a quiz. Now, I warn you about something. You go to Wikistupidia or Investistupidia or any AI, they will tell you a false definition. They will give you, and this is one of my chat traps on a test, is if someone gives the one I'm about to give you, I'll know that they went to an outside resource to get the answer. The wrong way to define it is liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be converted to cash. Two words are different, and they are very important. The right definition says efficiency, not ease. The reason is that ease is a fluff term. Efficiency means at the lowest cost. So the word ease you'll see in an internet definition, and that's incorrect. It's efficiency. And then that last thing, with which an asset can be converted to cash, that's what the wrong definition will say. Liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be converted into cash. It's another asset. Because if I say this the wrong definition, how do I define the liquidity of cash itself? Well, cash is liquid because it can be converted easily into cash. It doesn't do us any good. Besides which, quite frequently, you will convert an asset into something other than true traditional cash. So we have to have a stronger definition that can encompass any kind of asset. So we look at liquidity, and that is related to the solvency of a company. Can this company pay its short-term bills with its short-term assets? I want you to look here. In the current assets, cash has been, it popped up there for 1 year, and then it's been taking a nosedive. So in other words, their cash position, as far as liquidity is concerned, is eroding. They are holding less cash. Now the next one, receivables. Receivables have been skyrocketing. Here's the problem with current assets. We want to know what their effect is when they change, what the effect is on free cash flow. Let me do this one. If I have, well, let me do it this way. In my own company, last year at one exhibition, I sold one of my artworks. It was a massive piece for about $1,200. Okay, now, I reported on my revenues $1,200. Man, you really have a lot in your pocket, don't you? Not exactly, because $800 of that was on financing terms. So that revenue line actually overstated the cash that came out. My total revenue was definitely up $1,200, but only $400 of that was actually an increase in liquidity. The rest went into accounts receivable. So in other words, when accounts receivable goes up, your actual free cash flow goes down because it's being absorbed. Now, ultimately, I'll get that. I'll be paid, but not today. So the revenue line is telling us a false narrative about how much money was in my pocket at the end of that exhibition. The same is true of inventory. If you are buying inventory, increasing the amount of inventory in your warehouses, that is absorbing cash. It's actually sucking cash out of your pocket is what it's doing. As you increase your inventory, that also causes free cash flow to fall, because that cash is being absorbed into not money. It's being absorbed into what's not in your pocket. In general, when a current asset goes up, free cash flow dies. They are absorbing liquidity. They're taking it away. So seeing these numbers, both of those were going up. Is that true? Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. So in other words, they were actually draining free cash flow. Excuse me. And other current assets, can't really say much. Wow, whoa. Yeah, those are pretty minor. So your total current assets, which is weird, they put the total up at the top of the top. Most of the time you'll see that at the bottom of the current assets, but you know, they're just being a little bit difficult. In general, from 2021 to 2026, they actually increased their current assets, which decreased their free cash flow. Okay? I really want you to put that down in your notes, and if you've got, you know, put a box around it so you can see it on a quiz, and when you can use a note card front and back, 4x6 for the midterm. That's a good one to put on there, just to have it, because I usually ask you a question about it. Now look on the other hand at the current liabilities. You, sir, are a great employee. I pay you well. You work 40 hours a week and I pay you $50. Yeah, I'm a giver. Okay. 1 week, well, I put down minus $50 on my income statement for wage expense. Well, 1 week I say, you know, I'm not going to pay you this week. I got issues. And of course, you know, you call me a few very harsh names, criticize me heavily. And however, I'm still going to put the $50 down there, except that I'm not going to take it out of cash. I'm going to increase accounts payable, or wages payable, in fact. So in a case like that, I've actually helped my position, because I've got cash that I say I don't have. On the income statement, I said I paid $50. In reality, I got that $50 right in my pocket. So on the other side, wages payable goes up, free cash flow goes up. If I don't pay my suppliers, I put on the income statement that I paid them, but I push that over to accounts payable, that also helps free cash flow, because I've got cash that I said in the income statement I had spent. So in general, when a current liability goes up, free cash flow goes up. I can't emphasize this enough. Get these two down in where you can quickly reference them, because it's not counterintuitive, but you just don't think about it as an obvious thing right off the bat. Now I'm going to introduce you to a term, net working capital. Sometimes you'll hear me say net operating working capital. Net working capital. Net working capital is current assets minus current liabilities. In other words, it's the balance of your current assets versus your current liabilities. So when net working capital increases, in other words, current assets are overrunning current liabilities. If that goes up from one year to the next, free cash flow goes down. And similarly, if net working capital goes down, free cash flow goes up. Kind of do it mechanically until it sinks in. Just do the calculation and then you say which way free cash flow went. So let me show you something here. I'm going to do the calculation. I'm going to pull up a calculator here to do this. We want to see if their balance of current assets and current liabilities has been adding to free cash flow or draining it. Let me do something here. There's a calculator. Good. Okay, what I'll do is I'm going to do the net working capital for 2025. I take the current assets, which are 31.68. Well, let's try that again. 31.68 minus the current liabilities. Where the hell are the current liabilities? Come on. Total non-current, total liabilities. Do they even have that? Do they even list their total current liabilities? Current liabilities, thank goodness, there it is. Okay, minus, and so I will take minus 60.82. Total current liability, I'm sorry, 28.66 billion. So minus 28.66 billion. Minus 28.66 billion. So their net working capital in 2025 ended at a positive 3.02 billion. A little more in current assets than in current liabilities. Okay, that's good. So I'm going to save that here. Now I'll do 2026, the same thing. I'll take the current assets, 34.38 billion, minus the current liabilities, which are 32.42. So their net working capital has actually declined a little bit. So I take 1.96 minus 3.02. So their net working capital has actually declined from 25 to 26. So that freed up some cash. Now, I don't hit you with this right off the bat. I wouldn't do this on the next quiz. I need it to soak in a little bit. You have some homework problems to calculate it a couple of times. But what happened here was that in 2025, current assets minus current liabilities were 3.02 billion. By the time we get to 2026, current assets minus current liabilities was negative. So we've got a little bit of an opening of free cash flow here. Let me take that off before you take it too seriously yet, because I don't want this to overrun the main point that I'm making here. The financial statements here, I've gone through the income statement. Now, talking about the a few more lines here, just to get comfortable with it before I attack some numbers there, and I had to, but I want to get out of that real quick here. Let me go have a look here at their non-current assets. In other words, their fixed assets. What do you see there? Look at those four numbers from 2023 to 2026. What has happened to their fixed assets? Yeah, skyrocketed. They're on a building spree. They're putting up stores in everywhere. I mean, that's actually, they almost doubled in 4 years their footprint on the business landscape. That is a huge amount of addition. Now, you don't see that too often in non-high-tech companies. They just are trying to completely overwhelm the competition by building all these stores. I'm assuming that's what most of that increase in fixed assets was adding stores. Now, let's look at their debt. Remember why I told you I saw the interest expense going up? There it is. They're borrowing a lot of money to do this. They're growing. They're probably issuing stock too, but I mean, that's pretty impressive. Of course, now that I look at it, there's the working capital that I calculated right there. See the two numbers? See how their working capital declined? That freed up some cash for them. And we have a name for that. When you, like, for example, if a company slows down paying its suppliers, that's called spontaneous financing. Essentially, they're freeing up money for projects. I didn't pay you that $50. That frees up $50 so that I can do something with that money. It's on your back, obviously, but it's a way to get some of your financing for projects. There are some companies that are legendary for doing this. Walmart, if you look at their financials, I have a course you obviously want to take called Short-Term Financial Management or not. But one of the things you see are these companies like Walmart that actually finance all of their short-term operations on the backs of their suppliers. They have what we call a negative cash conversion cycle. They pay for everything short run with not paying their suppliers in a reasonable time frame. They sell stuff before they ever pay for the stuff that they put on the shelves. What you're buying, on average, Walmart hasn't paid its suppliers to put on the shelves yet. So this is one of those tools. When a company wants to free up some liquidity, it will lower its net operating working capital year over year. Now, one thing I want to have one quick look at here. Oh, before I go on, Home Depot, one of the things that it did over the past few years. Do you notice how its inventory dropped down to a low at the beginning of 2024 to $20.98 billion in inventory? By the time they got to 2026, January of 2026, they had jumped that by $5 billion inventory. Why did they do that? Does anyone know? because they saw those tariffs coming. And so they just bought hand over fist. Anything that they could sell, they bought before those tariffs started to kick in 2024 after the election. That's why you saw the inventory just jump through the roof. $5 billion on $20 billion, they increased their inventory by 25%. That's staggering. But they knew that these terrible tariffs were coming on all the stuff they buy from foreign suppliers, so they just stocked up on it like any rational person would do. They just bought it hand over fist. You notice also that they increased their accounts receivable over this period of time. Now, I would ask you this, but it probably wouldn't occur to you until I tell you anyway. Why does a company increase its accounts receivable? And it's the same reason I do, any company, because that gets more people to buy. If people walk into my show, they see $1,200, I don't have that in my pocket, but if I offer them financing, they're much more likely to buy from me. And it's a marketing strategy, is you increase the number of sales by offering people credit. And that's what Home Depot is doing here. It's drawing people into the store, drawing house builders into the store by saying you don't have to pay us right away. You can pay us on payments over a year or 2 years or whatever. So that was clearly, each of these numbers is actually telling us a story. That's the thing that I'm trying to emphasize from this, is that these numbers, if you just look at them cold, accounting numbers cold, they don't say anything to you. They're just numbers. But if you think about why, looking at the changes and what they tell us about the management's decision making, you can actually almost listen in on the executive meetings and see what the results were of their decisions. They're right in the numbers, whispering to us. One other thing that I want to show you here, I'm going to go over here to the statement of cash flows. What happened here? There it is. Okay, the statement of cash flows. Cash and total liability. Come on. Oh, cash flow. There's just a couple of quickie things that I want to show you here that are worth having a look at. This number right here, now it drives anyone who uses Excel crazy because they put this as a negative number. But this is what they actually spent. Like I told you about that lens. The depreciation doesn't say what actually happened. A huge amount of money happened. But if you look at the depreciation expense, that's saying a little bit happened each year for 5, 7, 10 years. But if you look here in the statement of cash flows, there's what they really spent. And they, as you can see, their capital expenditures have been going up from $3.1 billion in 2023 to $3.6 billion. So every year in 2023, they spent $3.12 billion on new places, new stores, or whatever. By the time we get to 2026, that year, fiscal year, they spent almost $3.7 billion. So they're ramping up. There's a kind of a joke thing about this. It's called the pharmacy strategy. Do you remember, I don't know if you noticed it, but over the past 10 years, you're starting to see Walgreens and CVS on virtually every corner of the United States. All they're doing is trying to saturate to beat their competitors. And their competitors are spending like hand over fist too. Essentially what Home Depot is doing is they're trying to saturate the market. They're just putting a Home Depot everywhere they can find. On every street corner, at the bottom of every lake, whatever they have to do, they're going to dominate the market. But then there's a question. Well, if you are taking monopolistic or almost quasi-monopolistic control of a market, that means that you should be a profit maker. You do that so that you can choke off competitors and have all of the market to yourself. But unfortunately, the income statement is telling us, yeah, they did increase their revenues, but they didn't bring that swing at the plate through to the gross profit line. Yeah, those stores are bringing in more money. More stores, more money. But somehow, by the time they get down to net income, that line right there is saying, you suck. So somewhere in there, they're expanding, getting bigger, but by the time you get to the bottom of it, it's not working. So there is sort of a, not necessarily the final judgment, but kind of a general judgment on management's, what it's doing right now. It's not as successful as you might think. Now, maybe in a longer run it will be, but for the time being, although I would not say, no, sell HD, this would be one of those where I take that position. Just hold your position. If you have some HD, don't sell it, but don't go running out there to buy more of it. Not unless they can prove, not unless or until they can prove that this vast expansion is actually paying off in higher profit. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.